It's the Olympic Cyborg edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Olympic Cyborg, Olympic Measles, and Naturopaths in Alberta. Let's begin episode 176.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away from the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your skeptical philosopher in political science. Ethan.
Yes.
Did you watch the Olympic opening ceremonies?
Are you referring to the opening ceremonies that were both described as very British and also terrible?
Yes. Well, apparently chimney stacks appeared from nowhere and there were hordes and hordes of sheep. And
lots of dancing, I see.
But apparently you were watching it and you said that, well, everyone there was so engaged and so amused.
Well, not everyone. I was watching the Parade of Nations. That's my favorite part. I like watching all the colorful flags. And the UK team came out, and they came out last because they're the host nation. And they cut from the UK team to the Queen. Now, usually when this happens, the head of state is standing and waving or something, and they look really proud. So they cut to the Queen, and what is she doing? Well, she's not standing and cheering at all. She's actually kind of sitting there fiddling with her fingernails and looking both bored and angry. It was the funniest thing I ever saw.
Yes, well, and of course, that was not her own unique moment, right? I mean, from what I understand, that this image was, well, actually, I don't think it was one of her looking at her fingernails, but one of her, like, sitting there saying, oh, my God. I mean, to be fair, like, she's, like, 80 years old. She's not really into the Olympic sports. I mean, she's into horse racing and that sort of thing. But I mean, it's been hours and hours. She's old. Her legs are tired. I mean, I don't blame her for really being old. I don't really blame her for being bored. I guess I can blame her for being old. But, you know.
Oh, there she lives so long.
Yeah. But I think one of the looks was like so like, oh, you. It's like she was taking a crash. Like she had this sort of, oh, you bastards look on it. And like that's been going around the internet, hasn't it?
Yeah, there's actually a pretty cool meme. It's a picture of the Queen looking rather angry with a caption that says, look at all those countries I used to own. And it suits her very well. She's sort of got this kind of evil monarch look in her eye, you know, sort of shooting lasers at the Parade of Nations that are prancing by. So it was quite entertaining. I mean, at the very least, you can always count on the Queen to, you know, fire a nasty look at, you know, a bunch of people carrying their own flag.
And what a sense of progress that represents. I mean, if we think about it, if that was like 100 or 200 years ago, it wouldn't be a nasty look she'd be shooting at them. It'd be cannon fire she'd be firing.
Well, they do have cannons.
Oh.
Well, they have missile launchers.
Oh, yes, on the roofs and such. But that would be a funny thing is at the end of the Olympics, they say, you know, China got 15 gold, the US got 15 gold, Britain got 15 gold, and recaptured 7 colonies.
Yeah, well, that's how the Olympics used to work.
Yes. But, you know, the Olympics, they are a-changing. As the Olympics are well underway, there's another controversy that sort of relates to a segment we did about performance-enhancing drugs. This year will be the first year the regular Olympics will have a cyborg competing. Isn't that cool?
Cyborgs are cool.
Yes. Oscar Pistorius will be competing in the individual 400 and 4x400 relay for South Africa. What makes Oscar unique is he has no feet and only about half of his calves on both legs due to a birth defect. Of course, this impediment has not kept Oscar out of sports. Actually, he's quite active in sports, and he will be competing at the Olympics. He will be wearing, apparently, carbon fiber prosthetics designed specifically for sprinting. Now, of course, this has raised the eyebrows of some of his competitors, obviously, and regulators who believe that Oscar may actually have an unfair advantage. In 2008, he was actually not allowed to compete in the Beijing Games. However, he has been given the green light for the 2012 games, and he'd be running this Saturday in the 400 meters race. Now, apparently the science behind this sort of says, well, yes, in one sense, he's going to gain an advantage moving from the crouch to the run. You know how all the runners sort of line up and they're crouched and they get ready to spring off? Well, you have to take your legs from that sort of behind you and swing it underneath you. And he apparently gets a good advantage, a speed boost, because he doesn't really have to do this. Of course, the countervailing factor, the thing that sort of evens the score, is that the reason why the runners get down and get a crouch is they kind of get a push off, a thrust. And because of the way his artificial legs are working, he doesn't get that. So they say, well, it's probably going to balance out. It should be interesting. And I suspect that if he wins a gold, they may go back and say, hey, wait a minute. However, if he wins the silver or less, it will look like another barrier for these able-bodied. I think that's the current PC term, isn't it? Well, anyhow, another barrier will be gone. But of course, you know, who knows what will be next?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because there is the Paralympics, which are designed for people who are amputees or in wheelchairs and that sort of thing. So it's kind of interesting why he was allowed into the ordinary Olympics, but other athletes who also have disabilities weren't allowed in as well.
Well, again, I think there are, I guess, really two ways to look at this. I mean, on the one hand, it doesn't seem to be quite fair that someone who, well, has all of their arms and all their legs to compete against someone who is missing parts of them and has to sort of compensate by something that traditionally has meant they have a disadvantage. Now, I think this is sort of stating to the level of technology and engineering that now these prosthetics, which usually meant that it would be a blowaway, there would be no chance for someone who was not with all their arms and legs would be able to compete. And now it actually looks as if maybe they will. So, I mean, in that one sense, before it was for the sake of the disabled-bodied, so that they'd actually have a chance to win. But what Oscar's doing, he's saying, well, listen, we don't need to have this sort of handicap. We now have the ability to compete sort of on an equal and level playing field.
And going beyond equal and going to an exceedingly better level. I mean, in many cases, if he's wearing or using a certain type of material that gives him an advantage over somebody who, you know, has to worry about their muscles cramping and tiring out, and he doesn't, that can be a significant advantage.
No, actually, I agree with that. And I think this is one of those things that there's going to be sort of a point where the engineering has improved the ability for the able-bodied to compete, but that's going to soon cross over and where they will have this definite advantage. But we were talking about before, I mean, so they'll have one advantage in this prosthetic, but maybe the guy he's running against is using steroids, and the other guy got a billion-dollar training grant to run on this super facility. So I guess it's one of those things, you know, when they put rocket launchers on the athletes as opposed to the apartment buildings, then we'll say, hey, wait a minute, this has gone one step too far.
Well, they already let them use high-powered sniper rifles and skiing equipment, so it may not be that far off.
That's true. You know, I never thought about that. That's a good point. So we've talked about Olympic cyborgs. Well, that's sort of the good side of things. There's also sort of a bad side to this, the Olympic disease. Besides medals and global goodwill, the Olympics will also be a possible source of an epidemic of measles. Now, any global event that mixes, in close quarters, an estimated 11 million people has the risk of being ground zero for a pandemic. However, this year, and this country, has made that much more of a possibility, thanks to quack medicine, and let's blame AltMed as well, because it has its role in here. The current sort of anti-vax movement really got started in England with the disgraced Dr. Wakefield. Is he still a doctor?
Not according to the British Medical Association, but I think he calls himself a doctor at his clinic in Texas, if I'm not mistaken.
Anyway, with his faked report falsely linking vaccination with autism, there's been a marked decline in vaccination of children in England for things like measles. Now, this in itself has caused sort of a double-digit rise in infections over the last decade, and will, however, be exacerbated by the Olympics. Now, of course, thanks to vaccination, measles rates are relatively low, even in places like England, which has had this sort of increase. So even those not vaccinated still sort of gain a benefit of herd immunity. But in parts of Europe, and most notably the world as a whole, measles are ever present, resulting in tens of thousands of deaths every year. With the Olympics in London, people infected from around the world would descend on this vulnerable population of British, American, Canadians who have been deceived or sucked in by sort of the anti-vax propaganda. People will be infected at the Olympics and then return home to infect their local communities. Often they will not even know that their children are sick because the incubation period for measles is about 1 to 2 weeks. I think this sadly may be an event that may awaken the sort of dim eyes of the anti-vax movement. I think what is happening it's best put by a mother whose child almost died because of someone else's unvaccinated children. She said, "People who choose not to vaccinate their children actually make a choice for other children and put them at risk." I think it's even more to the point what Bill Gates said in an interview at CNN when he said, "So it's an absolute lie that has killed thousands of kids. Because the mothers who heard that lie, many of them didn't get their kids vaccinated with either Petraeus or measles vaccine, and their children are dead today. And so the people who go and engage in those anti-vax efforts, you know, they kill children. It's a sad thing because these vaccinations are important." Do you agree with anything?
I always agree with Bill Gates.
It's very safe to agree with him.
He's got a pretty good track record. So, Don, we've talked about cyborgs at the Olympics. We've talked about pseudoscience and quack medicine at the Olympics. But it's time for the third pillar of free thought, a religious accommodation at the Olympics. That's right. This time, we have a Saudi Arabian judo competitor, one of the first two female athletes sent to the Olympics from Saudi Arabia. But she may withdraw from the competition if she is not allowed to wear her hijab or headscarf during the bouts. So on the one hand, we have a great thing that there are more women participating in the Olympics, and from a very conservative country, no less. But Olympic rules are in place for a reason. We're not talking about, you know, a fashion statement here. We're talking about safety. And as you can probably imagine, if you're wearing a full scarf while you're fighting in judo, you could really put yourself or your competitor or the spectators at harm. Well, I guess not the spectators, maybe the referee or whatever there is. But you could actually put yourself in danger by not wearing the, you know, required regulatory equipment. So, of course, the question is, how accommodating should the Olympic Committee be in allowing athletes who want to wear traditional religious dress, like the hijab here? Or are the Olympics, you know, about sport? And therefore, you know, it's not really their place to dictate what somebody can or cannot wear. If somebody wants to endanger themselves, that's their business. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, again, it's one of those things that I think in this case, the sports dictate, you know, what you wear, right? So I guess to a certain degree, you know, if you can be accommodated without actually having any undue safety risk or any undue advantage, okay, I don't like the reason for it. But if they had said, you know, can this person be dressed up in pink and do it? Well, okay. But when it comes to, you know, this is sort of the regulation uniform, this is what you're supposed to wear because this is the sort of standard, then no, I don't think it should be accommodated.
Well, the other issue at play here, especially with Saudi Arabia and a few other, you know, very conservative countries that have never sent female athletes to the Olympics, they only really agreed to this on the basis that these athletes would be not forced to dress in, you know, what they would consider provocative or impure dress. So meaning they would be allowed to participate so long as they maintained their cultural or socioeconomic status that they had back home. So for some of these athletes, they go to London, and they're expected to take off their traditional garb, put on their athletic clothing, and compete. And it reminds me of the old defections when you would have Soviet nations, and they'd be participating in Western countries, and their athletes would defect. And I wonder if perhaps they're a little bit concerned, these conservative countries like Saudi Arabia, that their athletes might go, you know what, I kind of like freedom. I'm going to stay here. And that could be an embarrassment.
That could be, actually. And, you know, once they get that taste of freedom, I think you are right in that sense, too, because I just hadn't thought about that in that particular way, is that in a way they're forcing the Olympic Committee to be oppressors of these women in the same way that they're oppressed at home. I mean, I don't know. If the women themselves, I mean, do they care or not? Or is this the government itself that's doing it? Because that makes, I think, a big difference. Because I think if the women said, well, and I mean, they're brainwashed, that type of thing, so there's a certain amount of looseness here. But if they said, well, I want to compete, but I don't want to compete this way, okay. But if they want to compete and the government says no because it's immodest, well, then I think, no, that's a doubly bad thing, right? I mean, they're not in Saudi Arabia. They're in this particular venue. If they're willing to do this, then they should be able to do it.
Yeah. Well, the big question, of course, is how do you determine which is which when they honestly, truly want to wear their traditional garb, or when they're being coerced or even just sort of culturally slotted into a position that they, you know, can't get out of? So a complicated question, I think.
Well, you know, and we're going to stretch a little longer here. We should be putting in a bit of a break, but one more thing, and this might lead us to a bit more talking than we want to. We'll see how it goes. But you're bringing up the idea of politics at the Olympics. I don't know if you've heard, but the Lebanese judo team actually has refused to train near the Israeli judo team, and they claim that it's because of, you know, Israeli involvement in Lebanon, and therefore the Lebanese team does not want to compete, does not want to be anywhere near them. They actually had to put up a sort of barrier between the two so they don't have to look at each other. And I mean, okay, we're not going to get into was Israel or Syria, Lebanon or what have you a bad thing, but the idea of politics at the Olympics, I mean, because you're kind of hinting with the Saudi Arabian argument that maybe we should kind of bring in political aspects into it. If it sort of forwards the spirit of the Olympics, but then doesn't that open this gate up for these other areas where it's not quite so black and white?
Well, I mean, I think you're hinting at one of the big problems with the Olympics that it's always have been there is that it is this sort of pseudo-political body, and it's not quite clear whether or not it's a force for things like democracy and freedom, or if it's about a demonstration of amateur athletic skill. And they've never really answered that question. I mean, you have this international body that goes into countries like China, like London and Vancouver, and, you know, they put up missile launchers and they block out Twitter accounts and they put on a big party and everyone likes it. But you have to wonder, I mean, like, how do they square that circle? Because the other big political controversy that was quite intense was there was no moment of silence for the Israeli athletes who were murdered in the Munich Games. And at a certain point, we have to ask ourselves this question: is the Olympics a political event, or is it an entertainment event? Because I think we can agree that if it's political, these are serious questions. If it's entertainment, there's still serious questions, but we can at least say, well, politics don't really belong in this particular venue. So we have to figure out how to understand the Olympics, because if we're going to say that it is political, then I think we have a lot of reason to be very concerned when they go into countries like China where there is egregious human rights violations. If it's entertainment, then, well, you know, we really shouldn't be looking at them to be sort of beacons of democracy or freedom or anything, really. They're more out there to put on a show, make some money, and throw a big party. And that's the paradox that I find with the Olympics. It, I often find myself just totally confused as to what exactly it is I'm watching.
Well, you know, and that adds to another layer, because I think my first reaction, it's not a sporting event. It's not sort of a cultural global event. It's an economic event. One of the things that I've been listening to a lot of my British podcast is sort of the sponsorship police that have been going around and making sure that, you know, only people who've paid to be sponsors have anything remotely Olympic in their windows and their signage and advertising. And oddly enough, it's kind of created a dampening down of Olympic spirit in London. You know, where you would expect in most other things, like when they had the Queen's Jubilee, you know, there was like bunting up and there was all sorts of, you know, the Queen is great sort of signs in all the windows. And there was a lot of grassroots excitement about it. But there's like next to none of that. Even places like there was one place I remember, a flower shop that had arranged their flowers in Olympic symbol, a butcher who had sausages and Olympic rings. And they were all told that they had to take them down because they were not official sponsors. So I think there's even another layer on top of that. I think ideally I'd like to see this as sort of a pause from politics, a pause from economics, a place where a bunch of people go together to sort of revel in the idea of competitive sports. Although even that is kind of weird. I was explaining to a friend, one of the things I kind of like about the Olympics is it's one of the few places where Europe can have a war again and not really, you know, have to worry about it. You know, in the old days you had tanks going across, but now they're fighting with these sort of proxy sports things. But it's still kind of a, you know, a major conflict, but just on the sports field.
Well, I mean, there probably is a reason why the Olympics started in Greece and kept going all these years, because it was one outlet for our insanely violent natures. But I think we're going too far, because if we keep talking about this, we're going to start talking about Steven Pinker's new book. So we should probably move on to our next segment here on Radio Free Thinker.
Well, before we do that, though, let's take a quick break. And when we return, we will talk about Alberta and homeopathy and naturopaths.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Ethan, stop, stop.
Stop, stop. What's going on?
Oh my God. Homeopathy. It might work. It might actually be a real thing. I mean, in Alberta, a group of so-called doctors took some truth and they continually diluted it over 14 years. And they've successfully inoculated the Alberta government against truth. Well, by truth, of course, I'm referring to the Ministry of Health stating that its aim as a department is to protect the health and safety of the people of Alberta. And, well, in the way that they've cured it, I mean, that the amount of protection they're apparently now offering is not much better than just drinking some water. I don't know if you've heard about this, but the Alberta government has passed a new law, regulation, that allows naturopathic doctors to be more doctors. It has beefed up the powers of these supposed doctors, giving them full status as medical practitioners, but sort of stopped short of funding treatment, so the Medicare won't actually cover it. But this does give the practitioners, both in Alberta and abroad, the air of legitimacy. It provides the College of Naturopathic Doctors of Alberta to self-regulate and provide accreditation.
One of the other things that is very disturbing out of this news is that Alberta is going to allow chiropractic to be subsidized for seniors. So Health Minister Fred Horn said the government is budgeting $7 million to give elderly citizens access to the controversial treatments. So that means that the government is going to be using taxpayer money to allow senior citizens to use some basically unproven and potentially dangerous medical treatments now subsidized in their Medicare.
Well, you know, and actually, I think it's even worse, you know, for the seniors. I mean, as you point out, the actual benefits of chiropractic in itself, above and beyond that which is sort of given for like lower back pain, and even then there's not a lot of evidence, but there's some. But with seniors, one of the big things you have is things like osteoporosis and thinning of the bones. And with this sort of violent back manipulation, I mean, I could see there being above and beyond the regular risks of things like stroke and that sort of thing, nerve damage, but literally breaking the back of seniors.
Well, I mean, for people who don't know a lot about the background of chiropractic, they might think, well, why is that a big deal? Surely senior citizens must need support for their backs. But you're forgetting that there's a whole other subset of chiropractic that really dives into some really scary woo. We're talking about people who believe that they can manipulate the spine to cure diseases, that they believe that the spine has innate healing properties, that the body is sort of a conduit for magical energy. And these are not, you know, out there claims. There is a significant size of chiropractors who believe this and practice this. So it actually is putting a lot of people at risk. And the other danger, of course, is that it's very difficult from a consumer's point of view to figure out which chiropractor supports the extended family of woo and which chiropractors focus mostly on sort of pain reduction that doesn't involve as much, but still some woo. So it's really putting senior citizens in a very unfortunate position. I hope that that some science-based proponents are able to help these people out, make sure they're making the correct decisions.
Well, actually, and I can answer your question, because if you go now to the Ministry of Health website, they have sort of a where do I get care from? And now they for naturopathic medicine, which would include chiropractic, is just a quick link to their own website. So essentially, the foxes are in charge of the hen house sort of thing.
This is scary.
Yes. Now, of course, now these doctors will now be allowed to do injections, minor surgery. And now minor surgery, from what was listed in the articles I said, are things like mole removal and all that, not like, you know, remove your heart and lungs or anything like that. Nasal and ear exams / insertions. Now, I use the word insertions because they also will be able to do things like shove herbs up your nose and in your ears and candling. They'll also be allowed to perform college-approved alt-med procedures. Now, in the actual College of Naturopathic Doctors of Alberta, in their press release, I noticed one thing that they say doctors will now be able to do. Intravenous administration of ozone. What is that, you may ask? Well, essentially, it's where they remove the blood, mix it with some ozone, and then re-inject it into your blood system. Now, ozone itself is three loosely bound oxygen atoms. Most of us have heard of this as the ozone layer that protects the sun from radiation in the atmosphere. But, of course, that's not what they want to do. Now, this is supposed to sort of cleanse the blood, but they overlook one very important thing about ozone. And this is why this whole alternative med thing is not really medicine and not really a good thing, not protecting it. The ozone itself is actually very reactive. And when injected, will, based on the effects that have done in animal studies, oxidize, forming a species of free radical known as reactive oxygen species. Now, these free radicals can damage cell walls. They cause things like wrinkling. They're also important with their links to cancer and other diseases. Now, of course, that being said, because, I mean, a lot of woo medicine has a kernel of truth where it begins with. So, yes, your body does actually use free radicals in a good way. But as is, like I say, so often the case, alt-med takes it to the extreme. So if a little is good, a lot must be better. Like sort of the constant claims about, you know, you need to strengthen your immune system. Well, not realizing that leukemia and arthritis, well, these are diseases where the immune system is too strong.
And I have a quote here from Mr. Horn to sort of add another dimension to what Don just said. So, quote, "We want Albertans to feel as secure in the education, competencies, and skills of practitioners to perform naturopathic services as they feel when they visit a medical doctor for medical services or a dentist for dental services or any other regulated health professional." Now, what they've accomplished is the exact opposite of what they set out to do. So not only are they incompetent, but they're terribly incompetent. And the idea that they're going to empower alternative medicine practitioners to perform things like minor surgery is so out of this world insane. They're going to have either a mountain of lawsuits in the next 5 to 10 years, or they're looking at some very serious, egregious violations of science-based medicine. Because you do not want to trust somebody who lights a candle on fire and puts it in your ear to perform minor surgery on you. I think that's pretty fair to say.
Well, and a funny thing is, too, is they say, well, one of the things, you know, this is supposed to strengthen it, because in order to get accreditation from the College of Neuropathic Doctors, you know, you need to go through 3 years of pre-med and then through one of their woo sort of systems. And because they use the word pre-med, you think, oh, well, they're getting medical training. Well, no, the word pre means before you get the medical training. So essentially, they do get sort of your Bachelor of Science degree. So, I mean, they do know chemicals and they do know that, but they're not actually treated to treat medicine. That's what you happen when you get the post-medical training. Actually, you know, like I say, this is like the accumulation of a 14-year battle by naturopaths to gain the status. Now, why do you think they need it? Well, again, beyond legitimacy, this procedure and prescriptions, their procedures and their prescriptions can now be claimed as medical expenses through some employer-sponsored health plan, and they qualify as income tax deductions. So this will likely lead to a tidy financial windfall for naturopaths. Now, remind me again how they're different from Big Pharma. I mean, surely it's not the money.
Well, I mean, they make a lot more money than quote Big Pharma does, and they're going to make a lot more with this. And it's also it's a snowball effect, because by gaining, every time they infiltrate another level of regulation, they get a bit more credibility, which they can in turn use to hook up more people onto their treatments, which in turn is very convincing for someone. If somebody tells you that they have a naturopath and it cured my allergies or something, then they're more likely to get more patients and more customers. So when you have a for-profit industry here, and that's what this is, and they're motivated to gain more customers, of course, and they're going through that method by going through regulatory bodies and gaining that recognition as medical providers, when honestly this industry is meant to make money. And that's the unfortunate outcome of this, is that you have, well, unproven and potentially dangerous treatments that are now going to be marketed to people seeking medical attention. And oh, well, the government says it's regulated and it just looks fair and good. And oh, sure, I'll sign up for it. It's going to cost a bit extra, but maybe it'll work. Well, that's called preying on people. And it's shameful that the government is considering supporting this. It's remarkable.
And actually, you know, that so goes in with one of the articles I read, and I must admit, I'm using this from memory, so I hope I'm getting it right. But one of the people who was sort of there for the minister's announcement was someone who's been like taking alternative medicine for a couple of years and says, oh, it works great. And she sort of said, well, you know, before I had to pay for this all on my own, and you kind of had to take it on faith. Right, you had to have faith in it in order to keep going, but now you no longer have to, because now it's going to be supported by, well, at least in theory, by the health plans and the government. And there you go, right? Again, it's this idea of legitimacy. The whole point of the Alberta Ministry of Health is to protect its people, and it says no. You know, although that being said, and we like to be good skeptics here, so I'm going to put you on the spot, Ethan. Now, already right now, there are people out there practicing naturopathic medicine. They're unregulated. They have no body to claim to. There is no sort of seal of approval. So even though this may be sort of a rubber stamp of forms, at least it is something to which, at least, you know, if I'm going to go for quack medicine, at least it's regulated quack, as opposed to the other guys who may really be more dangerous because nobody's even looking at them.
Well, I mean, the argument over whether or not woo science like this is more harmful or less harmful being regulated, I don't think that's a good argument to stand on, because it may not be regulated, but there is still standards they have to live up to. The Canadian Health Canada, as well as various Canadian laws, exists, and there are these laws on the books to prevent things like fraud and selling quack medicine and snake oil and all these things. So it's not like there is no way to prevent somebody from selling an ear candle. In fact, it's quite clearly made illegal by government order. So regulation in this case, I don't think actually does any benefit. And the downside, of course, as we've been talking about, giving them more more influence and that prestige that they can now say to their clients, hey, look, the government is regulating us, ergo we are, you know, legitimate science. I don't think it's a very good trade-off.
I think I would agree with you, actually, and I think you went the exact path I would have gone. Is that, yes, you know, you may shut down some of the worst of the worst, but alternative medicine is, in most cases, not medicine. And you encourage people to not treat themselves. They tend to suffer a lot more just from the fact that they're not being treated, let alone the fact that some of these treatments are very questionable, like chelation therapy, right, where you're supposed to purify. It's the same therapy they use if you actually do have heavy metal poisoning, but they do it on people who don't have heavy metals poisoning. And when you do it on people who have been poisoned by heavy metals, it's very bad for you, but to leave the heavy metals in your body is even worse. So it's bad, but it's a trade-off. But if they do it just to purify your body, you're getting all the negatives, but there is no sort of positive upside to it. So you're right. It leads to this legitimization that people will say, well, it can't be bad. It can't be untrue, because it's got a government approval on it, so it must be a legitimate thing. And you're right. I think far more people will be harmed by regulating it than who would have been harmed if it wasn't regulated and sort of kept in the back alley. The
thing, too, is Health Canada and other regulatory bodies that currently exist and are in place to prevent quack medicine from getting out there and harming people, you know, honestly aren't doing that great of a job of preventing it in the first place. You know, a lot of times when there's a violation, the solution is a slap on the wrist or a small fine of maybe, you know, a couple thousand dollars, which you think a couple thousand dollars might be like a lot for someone who's operating out of their garage or something. But for some of these organizations, they're multi-billion dollar companies. That's not a deterrent. They don't care if they have to pay an extra $1,000, you know.
It's cost of doing business.
Yeah, and they just laugh that off. I mean, the thing that I find remarkable is that, you know, a show like Marketplace can expose homeopathy, can expose Cold FX, can expose all these products. How often has Health Canada, like, taken them down? Has it ever happened? I don't know, because I don't ever really see things on, like, you know, the National Post or the Globe and Mail that Health Canada storms warehouse, you know, takes into custody thousands of pounds of fake medicine that was going to be sold to people as a cure for cancer. That's a feel-good story, and I've never seen it happen.
No. And, you know, and there's another aspect that you probably don't know because it's sort of tangential. But I was reading about a month or two ago that actually, you know, a lot of these fines are actually never paid. Apparently, there's something like a 5 to 7% payment rate on these kind of fines by business. So, I mean, there's not really even a major penalty for doing this. Now, of course, there is the possibility of a small, thin, wafer thin silver lining. They are now apparently officially prohibited from performing 14 procedures, or at least that's what the press report stated. Now, that said, I have yet to find out what these may be. I've even, like I say, I went to the Ministry of Health website, and I scanned it as quite as well, and I could find nothing about it, which, of course, just leads me to think it's a conspiracy.
Well, I mean, some conspiracies do happen. Anytime people get together to plot to break the law, that's a conspiracy. And given that in many cases it is illegal to sell products like this in Canada, we could say it is a conspiracy.
So when we return, we will have our skeptic highlight.
Tool ever devised for understanding how the world
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you. And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. We're running out of time on today's show, so we should go to our skeptical highlights. These, of course, are our highlights of upcoming events, or perhaps a book that you should be reading, or just something you should keep your skeptical eye on. So, Don, what are your highlights this week?
Well, I have something to keep your skeptical brain on. Oh, brain.
Brain.
Yes. Google Labs has set up an exhibition at the Science Museum in London. Of course, in true Google style, it was not intended to be sort of a traditional display only, so they've combined the exhibition with Google Chrome to launch Google Web Labs, where they have virtual visitors from around the world to be able to interact with the displays and perform five different experiments in the comfort of your home. Now, the exhibits include Universal Orchestra, Data Tracer, Sketchbotch, Teleporter, and Lab Tab Explorer. Now, these are kind of quirky, fun sort of things. I went to them. It wasn't that bad. It wasn't, you know, super brain baking or anything. But it was interesting how they sort of took what would normally be, I have to pay, you know, whatever I need to get into the museum. But it's just in the museum. This is taking the idea of a science museum, so a scientific experimental sort of mindset, and allowing anyone in the globe to kind of go there for the afternoon. And I thought that was actually quite a good, exciting thing. Now, the other one I have, and now this one, of course, is out of this world, literally, or, well, not literally, but figuratively. The University of Edinburgh is offering a free online 5-week course called Astrobiology and the Search for Extraterrestrial Life. Now, from their website, over 2,000 years ago, the ancient Greeks wondered if other worlds were habitable. In the coming years, this question will be examined and tested. This course is an introduction to astrobiology. It explores the origin and evolution of life on Earth and its potential to exist elsewhere. Astrobiology addresses compelling questions in wide interest, such as how did life originate on Earth? Is it an inevitable process? Is life common across the universe? Astrobiology is an interdisciplinary science that bridges fields as diverse as astrophysics, biology, geoscience, and chemistry. In this course, one will explore what we know about life's ability to live in extreme environments on Earth, look at different hypotheses for how it originated. You will look at some of the missions to search for life in our solar system and on other planets orbiting distant stars, discuss some of the extreme environments on Earth that help us understand the limits of life and how life has adapted and coped to these extremes, explore the possibilities of intelligent alien life and some of the implications of its detection. The course will provide a foundation in astrobiology and introduce students to the concepts of a diverse scientific fields. So have I got you hooked, Ethan?
Hooked, for sure.
Well, you can sign up now, and there'll be a link on our website, but you'll have a little bit of time to do your prep work because the course itself doesn't actually start until January 2013, assuming, of course, we survive the Mayan apocalypse. It sounds like something that's really, really exciting. I would recommend to go and sign up. I'm not sure how limited it will be. A lot of these online courses don't have a maximum number of people who can, but some of them do. It's free. It's international. Why not become an astrobiologist? Would that not look really impressive on a resume?
I think it would look pretty impressive, actually. Now, my skeptical highlights this week, I have a couple here. The first one is a cafe inquiry by CFI Vancouver. This is called The Limits to Growth. Now, Cafe Inquiry is a monthly casual discussion group, and we encourage you to come along. There will be coffee and tea and cookies. And our speaker this time is Patrick Walden. Pat is a research scientist at the Triumph Cyclotron Laboratory at UBC, and he'll be discussing limits to growth. Will there be an endless drive to continually expand, and will that drive hit a wall? What will happen to our civilization in the 21st century? Sounds very interesting, and it's happening Saturday, August 18th at 11 a.m. at SFU Harbor Center. The room will be announced shortly. Now, the other event that I would like to mention is the Humanists in the Pride Parade. And, of course, the Pride Parade is Sunday, August 5th, and the BC Humanists will be marching in the Pride Parade at 12:30 in the afternoon. So you just got to show up, and I believe they're meeting around Robson Street between Broward and Thurlow. So for Vancouver residents, that's where they'll be. And they encourage you to march with them. If you want to march halfway and then head off, you can do that as well, or you can just stand on the side and wave as they go by. But either way, it's a great opportunity to for skeptics and free thinkers to interact with the broader civil rights movement. So I encourage you to go check that out.
You're going to remind people to bring like their knee pads, right? Because we always know pride goeth before a fall.
Sure, Don. I encourage you to bring your knee pads in case you fall.
Oh, and we forgot one other thing. Oh my God, I can't believe we forgot this, Ethan.
What is it, Don?
Next Sunday at about 9 p.m., maybe 10, is the Mars lander, the Curiosity's landing on Mars, the 7 most terrifying minutes in NASA history. I highly recommend all our listeners to just go to the NASA website. They're going to have live streaming of the event, from what I understand. Actually, I understand that some places are having Curiosity parties that night to sort of, hey, we're landing on Mars again. It's really, really an exciting thing, and it's happening Sunday at about 10 o'clock. Of course, it's happening Monday if you live in London and all that, but isn't that exciting?
Well, it certainly will be exciting, assuming that the probe actually survives its descent to Mars. If it just kind of explodes, that's going to be kind of a bust.
Yes, well, I'm sure they'll have CGI to fix that particular error.
Or they could just, film it on a studio back home.
Yes.
I do have one other highlight I want to mention for our listeners. Now, if you happen to be near Eugene, Oregon, there is a conference called the Skeptics Toolbox. This is a bit different than your average skeptical conference. It's more of a big workshop, and it's created by Ray Hyman, who has been heavily involved in the skeptical movement for many, many, many years. And the Toolbox Conference began in 1989. So it's actually sort of like skepticism intense. It's got a lot of really important training and methods and research materials that you can learn about and add to your own sort of portfolio of investigation. The conference is on August 9th to the 13th, and it's at the Living Learning Center in Eugene, Oregon. So I encourage you to check that out, skeptictoolbox.org. It's pretty popular amongst the skeptic community. And if you are a group organizer, or perhaps you want to get involved with a local skeptical organization, it's a great way to learn the ins and outs of how to do skeptical investigation and how to be, a good critical thinker.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, critical thinking is good. All I need to do is cheer that, right? I don't need to say, Ethan, I think that should critical thinking be important? No, it is. Woo! So I guess we've reached the end of the show. I'd like to thank you all for showing up. So this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening and see you next week, folks.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelation.
You know, religious people have such beautiful music and art, and atheists really have nothing. Until now. Little tune called Atheists Don't Have No Songs.
Christians have
their hymns and pages.
Hymns and pages.
Habaneguilas for the Jews.
For the Jews.
Baptists have the Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages.
Atheists just sing the blues.
Romantics play
Clair de Lune.
Clair de Lune.
Born again, sing He is risen. But no one ever wrote a tune.
Wrote a tune.
For godless existentialism.
For atheists,
there's no good news.
They'll never sing
a song of faith.
In their songs,
they have a rule.
The He is always lowercase. The He is always lowercase.
Some folks sing
a Bach cantata.
Bach cantata.
Lutherans get Christmas trees. Atheist songs add up to nada.
Up to nada.
But they do have Sundays free.
Have Sundays free.
Pentecostals sing to heaven.
Sing to heaven.
Coptics had the book of scrolls.
Numerologists count to seven. Count to seven.
Atheists have rock and roll.
For atheists,
there's no good news.
They'll never sing
a song of faith.
In their songs,
they have a rule.
The He is always lowercase. The He is always lowercase.
Atheists
don't have no songs.
Christians have
their hymns and pages.
Hymns and pages.
Habaneguilas for the Jews.
For the Jews.
Baptists have the Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages.
Atheists just sing the blues.
Catholics
dress up for Mass
and listen to
Gregorian chants.
Atheists
just take a pass.
Watch football in their underpants. Watch football in their underpants.
Atheists
don't have no songs.
Don't have no songs.
Thank you very much.
Is the next logical step in our space program. It's the challenge that's been staring us in the face for the past 30 years.
It has water, it has carbon, it has a 24-hour day, it has geothermal energy. Mars is a place we can settle.
There is a giant rift in its surface, 5,000 kilometers long. There is a volcano as wide as Arizona.
So there's the choice in life. One either grows or one decays. Grow or die. I think we should grow.
Mars is a world of wonders.
It has canyons, river valleys, and giant ice sheets.
Mars is a world of wonders.
It shouldn't be humans to Mars in 50 years. It should be humans to Mars in 10.
We even
either muster the courage to go, or we risk the possibility of stagnation, cosmic radiation, zero gravity, Martian dust storms, back contamination. But these are dragons that we can take on.
In our time, we have sifted the sands of Mars, established a presence there, and fulfilled a century of dreams.
The Mars rovers have really captured our imaginations. They genuinely are explorers in the old-fashioned sense.
If you put out a call for volunteers for the first crew to Mars, they'd be lined up coast to coast.
Mars is a world of wonders.
It has canyons, river valleys, and giant ice sheets.
Mars is a world of wonders.
It shouldn't be humans to Mars in 50 years. It should be humans to Mars in 10.
Mars is a dry, frozen version of our home, covered in red dust and sand.
At one time, in the ancient past, Mars was very similar to the condition of earlier.
There will always be people with new ideas on how humans should live together.
We now have eyes and ears on the surface.
What's left after you go is the good you left behind. You have to believe in hope. You have to believe in the future. There are more and more people coming around to the point of view that a positive future for humanity requires human expansion to space.
Mars is a world of wonders.
It has canyons, river valleys, and giant ice sheets.
Mars is a world of wonders.
It shouldn't be humans to Mars in 50 years. It should be humans to Mars in 10.
This is a world of wonders.
We're at a crossroads today. We either muster the courage to go, or we risk the possibility of stagnation in the kingdom.
Is a very human form of knowledge. We are always at the brink of the known.
Science is a collaborative enterprise spanning the generations. We remember those who prepared the way, seeing through them also.
If you're scientifically literate, the world looks very different to you, and that understanding empowers you.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
The story of humans is a story of ideas that shine light into dark corners.
Scientists love mysteries. They love not knowing.
I don't feel frightened by not knowing things. I think it's much more interesting.
There's a larger universal reality of which we are all a part.
The further we probe into the universe, the more remarkable are the discoveries we make.
The quest for the truth in and of itself is a story that's filled with insights.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
there's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
The story of humans is a story of ideas that shine light into dark corners.
From our lonely point in the cosmos, we have, through the power of thought, been able to peer back to a brief moment after the beginning of the universe.
I think that science changes the way your mind works, to think a little more deeply about things.
Science replaces private prejudice with publicly verifiable evidence. There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.